It's NOLA History Guy podcast for Saturday, June 8th, 2019. And welcome to the pod. Hope you've enjoyed listening and joining us for Derby Gisclair's, our conversations with Derby Gisclair about baseball, because that was just so much fun. We're going to go back to a short form pod today, just two items for the podcast. We're gonna do our pick of the week for today in New Orleans history or NewOrleansPast.com. And then we're going to talk a little bit about Chalmette Cemetery, because some comments have come up on the Facebook page that kind of merit, I guess the best way to say it is a bit of repetition, you know, about the origins of the cemetery. So sit back and we'll just do a couple of short things today and let's get started. Okay, so our first item for the pod today is going to be our pick of the week from Today in New Orleans History. Now, that's the Facebook page that Catherine Campanella keeps up. And the website, for those of you who don't Facebook is a verb. That's an interesting concept. Anyway, for those of you who aren't on Facebook, her website is NewOrleansPast, all one word, .com. And the pick of the week is the June 6th pick, which specifically, she's got an item for June 6, 1918. Work begins on the Industrial Canal. Now, just to kind of back up for a second, let's take a moment and just quickly review the progression of canals that tie the city to Lake Pontchartrain. Of course, the original quote-unquote canal was going to be on Canal Street, and I think everybody kind of knows that basic fact, or at least anybody who lives here knows that basic fact. That's why Canal Street's so wide, you know, 141 feet and the whole bit. The idea was that was where Depaget and Bienville kind of saw the idea of, yes, we will replace the old portage with a canal somewhere along the lines. And so that's where that developed. But over time, it didn't quite work out that way. Now, the first canal that comes from the city heading up towards the lake is the Carondelet Canal, which was built in 1795. Now, the idea behind the Carondelet Canal was basically a short run that would tie the French Quarter and, just north of the French Quarter, from just a straight run up to the end, or the marshy end, if you will, of Bayou St. John. So this is now, this is 1795. Now, they kind of always had the idea of the canal on Canal Street going back to the 1730s. Never got around to it for various reasons. By the time, by the 1790s, we're talking about Spanish colonial New Orleans. And the Spanish, For all that the French obviously did not like the fact that the Spanish government, colonial Spain, New Spain, took over New Orleans, the Spanish are pretty thorough. So, and of course that gets into the building codes that improve things after the fires and all of that sort of thing. And one of the targets, one of the plans that the Spanish government and the merchants in the area had was to basically eliminate what was called the Old Portage. Now, you'll see that sign that says exactly that, the Old Portage, up along Bayou St. John by Orleans Avenue. And the name stems from the idea of the fact that if you were coming to New Orleans by water, either you came down the Mississippi or you came into the you came into Lake Pontchartrain through basically through the Wrigley's Pass or through Chef Mentor Pass. You came in from the Gulf to Lake Bourne through one of the passes into Lake Pontchartrain, and then you could come down Bayou St. John. But when you hit what's now Mid-City, when you hit what's now Jefferson Davis Parkway, right there by Parkway Bakery, right there, Hagen Street, and the old Brake Tag Station and everything, was and still is the end of Bayou St. John. Now, of course, back in the day, there really wasn't the end wasn't as distinct at that point because it was just this marshy merging of Bayou Metairie and Bayou St. John that all kind of came together, and it was just a swampy mess. Well, by 1795, back to the old portage. So that was the end of the waterway. So you could come in on a boat from the lake and then go down Bayou St. John. But when you hit that Mid-City area, now you had to pick the boat up and carry it back to the French Quarter. Or vice versa, if you wanted to get out, you know, because you could come down the Mississippi River in a canoe or a small boat, but going back up the river with that current wasn't really going to happen. So it was the same thing in reverse, that you would have to go, basically you'd have to take your boat from the French Quarter and then hoof it back to the end of Bayou St. John, where you could then put your boat back in the water and go up the bayou to the lake and then back wherever you needed to go. So the idea, of course, with the original canal, the Carondelet Canal, was to tie the French Quarter to that end of the bayou, and that happened in 1795. That canal gets filled in the 1920s, and that ties to this story. The catch was, the reason there was never a canal on Canal Street was because the Creoles wanted a canal that they could control, as it were, in the sense that if they built the canal on the downtown side of Canal Street, you know, where the Carondelet Canal is, and that's, you know, the basin on Basin Street, and geez, you know, we've got a bazillion different things that we've written about before about this. I'll put that page particularly on the show notes this week. So the idea was that basically the Creoles, the controlling families and the businesses of the city were able to control the waterway, and that gave them one up over the Anglo-Irish, the Americans that had basically had started moving into the quote-unquote American sector on the other side. Now, when I, you know, it's 1795, there's not a lot of America just yet, but that's going to change, right? So as then, of course, the Louisiana Purchase and the American influence begins to grow, but now, you know, we're starting to get 1820, 1830, that Carondelet Canal is now 30, 40 years old, and the control of it, the turning basin there on Basin Street, and then just directly into the French Quarter for servicing those businesses and light industry developing along the canal through Faubourg Tremé. You kind of get the idea. The Anglo-Irish, well, they wanted something of their own, so that's by the late 1830s. That's where the new canal comes in, or you'll also hear it referred to as the new Basin Canal. And so the basin for that canal, the terminating point for that canal was on South Rampart Street. So they start digging the basin at South Rampart Street and then moving north and then curving straight north, curving up and basically going up towards Lake Pontchartrain out at West End. And that's where the new canal and the new canal lighthouse and the little bit of the canal that's left. You get the idea. So by the 1840s, we now have two canals that are coming from the lake. So there's essentially three paths that you could that were used to move commercial goods and people, for that matter, from from the shore of Lake Pontchartrain back down into the city. You had the new canal in the that ended up in the American sector on South Rampart Street. You have the Pontchartrain Railroad, and which connected Milneyburg, which is basically where Pontchartrain Beach where Pontchartrain Beach was, but prior to that was the Port Milneyburg and the port facility, the pier and the port facility that was there, that was tied to a 4.5 mile railroad that was ran straight down what is now Elysian Fields Avenue. And then, of course, you had Bayou St. John in between those two, and Bayou St. John leading to the Carondelet Canal, leading to the Turning Basin on Basin Street. And that was your three big ways to get into the city. By the turn of the century, by 1900, things started getting the usefulness of the canals was still very solid. You know, you could it was easy to, you know, have fishing boats and oyster luggers and that kind of thing could come out of the Carondelet Canal into Bayou St. John, but it just didn't really draw. It's like it was low draft boats, you know, just shallow water boats. The new canal was a little bit deeper, and you could have tugboats and you could have other small craft that was servicing the city from that side. Of course, you could have decent-sized ships coming into the lake, but, you know, the lake starts getting shallow as well, so you have to, you know, kind of address that. You had basically schooners and small steamers coming in as late as the, you know, the Civil War and Reconstruction coming into Milneyburg. But even then, the draft of the ships by the 1850s and 1860s were kind of putting Milneyburg as a port was losing its influence because of the fact that the lake didn't permit deep water boats or deep water ships. So of course that still leaves the river, and the river was still pretty awesome in that respect. So you still had that level of commerce, but the idea of tying the lake to the river was still an obsession for New Orleans in a lot of ways. So by the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, you see more discussion of this. And this really starts taking shape in 1914. The state government gives the authorization to the Port of New Orleans to start building the canal. And of course, it takes some time to plan this out and sort out exactly how you're going to approach this. And the idea was to build the canal to the east of the Pontchartrain Railroad, but, you know, not so far out that you were just going out into the wetlands. So the idea was to build out the canal so that the entrance on the riverside would be downriver from the French Quarter, coming into what is now, you know, what at this point is, you know, well established as the Ninth Ward. So the canal gets dug there on Poland Avenue. That's the next big street, the biggest street that's on the western side of the Industrial Canal. And the construction on that, the planning starts in 1914 to start looking, figure out what the best approach is. And June 6, 1918 is when the actual digging, the dredging of the canal begins. And so that's the whole strategy, or that's the idea behind it. Now, the canal itself runs from right by Poland Avenue, a couple blocks further past, and then you have the big you had the big military installation there, the big Army supply and the supply depot and point of departure depot there at the end of the Industrial Canal. And then specifically just after just at the river, a set of locks had to be built to match the height of the water in the canal with the river, because the two were uneven. So ships that were coming into the coming to the river from the canal would have to then be raised up to the river, and then they could flow out and vice versa. So that was an addition as well. Now, the original length of the canal was a little over 5 miles. It with a 1,600 foot right of way. So basically, it's expanded a little bit from 5.3 to 5.5 miles over time, and that's mainly because of land reclamation on the lake side. You know, when the levee board starts the dredging of the of Lake Shore, you know, what becomes Lake Shore Drive, and basically land reclamation up on the lake side of the canal comes up from there. Now, the canals had, you know, some history, obviously, the worst of which, some controversial or bad history, I guess is the way to say it, in particular because of Hurricane Katrina and the breach in the flood walls in 2005. And then, you know, of course, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers had much to answer for with that. But overall, the Industrial Canal has served the purpose that for which it was built, and that was to allow ocean-going ships or deep-water ships to be able to come further in and basically to extend the port facilities away from the river of a bit further north. And that's been a big thing, because you've got big railroad yards on either side of the canal. You know, you've got the Norfolk Southern Yard on the western side of the Industrial Canal in Gentilly, and then you've got the CSX yard, the old Louisville and Nashville yard, that's on the east bank it's technically New Orleans East at that point. And overall, it's just been a big boon for a number of reasons for this century that the canal has been in existence. So for all that, and by the way, let's make a distinction too, because you'll see that Campanella mentions the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet, MRGO, affectionately or not affectionately referred to as Mr. Go. The Mississippi River Gulf Outlet is quite controversial because of its effect on flooding and flood conditions in the area, but the Industrial Canal, nobody really had any of those concerns anywhere near like with Mr. Go, the two are not directly connected. Of course, you can come out of the Industrial Canal and then you go down the river and you end up in the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet. There's not a direct connection there, but you get the idea that the catch is that while Mr. Go has been controversial since it was dug, the Industrial Canal is not really has not that's not up the concerns in terms of it being bad for the city or bad for flooding and bad for Chalmette and St. Bernard Parish. Certainly that the Industrial Canal doesn't hit those kinds of, that's never been an argument. The controversy with Katrina in 2005 is the maintenance of the flood walls and the fact that that breach really did serious, just such tragic damage to the lower Ninth Ward. But again, that's a different issue as well. You could say that it wouldn't have happened if the canal would never have been there. But the canal overall, it's safe to say, has been a good investment in terms of the port and the city and keeping things going. This all begins, of course, on June 6, 1918, which is why it's being recognized, that's a thing this week. So next time you're driving over I-10, or if you're driving over the St. Claude, catch the train again. If you're coming over the St. Claude Avenue Bridge over the Industrial Canal, or you're going over the Danziger Bridge at coming in on Gentilly Boulevard and, coming up through and into New Orleans East that way, you can always, people always tell you can smell the Folgers coffee plant as it's roasting coffee there, and all sorts of other, interesting industrial sites as we're going along. If you watch NCIS New Orleans, The fictional Industrial Canal has a lot more Navy than you would think on the canal area. You know, they kind of make it look like there's more naval installation than actually is there, but it works out, you know, because it's some good potential for filming and for shooting. So it's they tend to use that area a good bit as well. Okay, so that's our pick of the week. Then is the Industrial Canal starting construction on June 6th, 1918. So let's go ahead. We're going to take a little bit of a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about Chalmette Cemetery. NOLA History Guy podcast is sponsored today by Elysian Fields Press, publishers of Dragon's Discovery, book 2 of the Bloodbound series by Edward Branley. Dragon's Discovery is a young adult novel that's the second book in the story of the Bloodbound, who are basically three teenagers from Metairie who acquire a dragon's egg, and it goes from there. Can a video game become reality? David, Anne-Marie, and Joey are ready to start another school term after a laid-back summer getting to know their dragon. The difference is they are bloodbound to Eleni of the Red Tribe. As if school, band, and drinking chicory coffee are not keeping them busy enough, they are now part of the world of the dragons. Join the trio as their days are filled with curiosity, intrigue, and a new video game, while Eleni, the guardians, companions, and merchants guide them through their discovery of life and love. Dragon's Discovery, Book 2 of the Bloodbound series, is available in paperback and in Kindle from Amazon.com, and signed copies of all of Edward Branley's books, including the Arcadia History books, the History Press Krauss book, the Hidden the Talents, Bayou Talents books, Hidden Talents and Trusted Talents, as well as the two books in the Bloodbound series, are all signed copies of all of those books are available for order for purchase at Elysian Fields Press. So that's ElysianFieldsPress.com. Elysian Fields Press, all one word, .com. And we're back. There's kind of a reason why we're going to talk about Chalmette National Cemetery today. There's the biggest thing is military cemeteries or military honoring the military becomes a big deal at the end of May, coming up into the beginning of June, mainly because of two significant dates. And of course, that's Memorial Day, where we honor all of the American dead, American military dead who've fallen in battle. And then, of course, going up into June 6th, which is D-Day, and with the 75th anniversary, that becomes a thing as well. But in particular, Chalmette National Cemetery tells an important, or is part of another important story in terms of our military and our military dead. And that in particular is the story of what's known as the USCT, or United States Colored Troops. And Chalmette Battlefield, Chalmette Cemetery gets involved, or, you know, its involvement with this begins at the end of the Civil War. Because basically what happens is that by 1864, now remember, the city of New Orleans has been under Union control since May 1st of 1862, when Butler comes in. So by 1864, the Union Army has been dealing with war dead and war casualties coming into New Orleans now for 2 years. And essentially, they need a place to bury the dead. We had basically you start seeing some pop up interments in different parts of the city. Other different cemeteries would take the war dead. But the problem that the Union Army ran into was the idea of burying, in particular, African American soldiers. And basically the USCT, the United States Colored Troops. Now, some of the USCT, the colored troops, those African Americans were from South Louisiana and from New Orleans. And, you know, you could make arrangements, families would make arrangements to bury their loved ones. But when you start having all of the men who were fighting in the Union Army that had come from the North or had come from other Southern states and had volunteered to join the Army, then that became a bit of a problem. Now, there were burials going further back at Chalmette Battlefield, specifically we're talking about towards the back of the battlefield. And what I mean by the back is if you drive into the battlefield, you enter Chalmette National Battlefield basically, you enter the battlefield and you're on essentially what is then the American side as far as the battle in 1815. And if you look across the battlefield, you see a lone Union Jack. You see a lone UK flag flying on, you know, pretty far out, which marks the beginning of the advance in January of 1815 of Pakenham and his army. So if you go just past that flag, there's a stone wall, and that's the piece of the battlefield that the Union Army took in 1864 and blocked off as part to turn it into a basically an army cemetery. So it's now designated as a United States National Cemetery, and it's basically the back of the battlefield. And that area had been essentially, it was private land for that time from 1815 to 1864. Then the state had taken ownership at some point, but now the Union Army's in control and they can pretty much do whatever they want with it. So they essentially turn that area, say, okay, this is going to be the battlefield area, and this is where we'll remember the Battle of New Orleans, and we're going to take this back piece from there. It's 17 and a half acres, and we're going to make this a graveyard. We're going to make this a cemetery, and that's going to give us a place where we can bury these men who have fallen in the Union cause. By the way, as a side note, there were Confederate burials. There were rebel burials in Chalmette National Cemetery initially as well, because, well, the Union Army had to, you know, had to bury the folks one way or the other. Those men were reinterred in a tumulus in Greenwood Cemetery through a private effort in the 1880s. So it's pretty much now what you end up with is there are over 15,000 men and women buried in Chalmette National Cemetery now, and so many of them are U.S. colored troops. Now, where is this going, or why are we talking about it today? Well, there was a memorial that I'd switched over. I was looking at some stuff online, and I noticed there is a page on Facebook, we'll post the link to it, that documents U.S. colored troops burials. And up in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, recently, a memorial to the USCT was dedicated up there. So, you know, one of the things I do with NOLA History Guy is I tend to on the Facebook page to present stuff that's kind of not always New Orleans, because it's my interest. I'm a history guy, you know, it's that kind of thing. So I see this USCT thing and I share it. And then, of course, it never fails that there's always somebody that comes out and just starts losing their minds because I'm talking about black people. And so essentially I'm posting this thing and I made a comment. I said, we really should have some kind of monument to, you know, a collective, an aggregate monument, possibly at the cemetery, to all of the fallen colored troops that are buried there, because it's just so many of those men. And in particular, there's so many of those markers out there that are unknown. In other words, basically, it's not even it's like you see the headstones and the crosses and that kind of thing in Arlington National Cemetery, and everybody, or you, in particular now, you know, you see the American Cemetery in Normandy, and then there's the Netherlands American Cemetery in Margraten, plus a whole bunch of others over there, and you see just those fields of crosses and that kind of thing. And it's a very moving thing. But if you go down to Chalmette, there what's moving is the fact that it's just these small little stones with a number on it, because there's so many of those men, those USCT soldiers, that nobody knew their names. And so they're buried as unknowns, and it's just an incredible number of men that are down there in unmarked, well, not un, they're marked, but they're marked as unknown. They're just in numbered plots down there. And so I was thinking, you know, it would be appropriate, you know, there is the big Grand Army of the Republic monument that's at the river end of Chalmette National Cemetery, because the riverside, the river road side of the cemetery was the original entrance, but flooding and the Batcher and everything else just complicated that. So that piece of river road just kind of merged into the levee over time, and the entrance was relocated and changed, so it's on St. Bernard Highway side now instead of the river. So, and so I keep thinking, you know, it would be nice to, I just mentioned this, that it would be nice to have a monument, a general, an aggregate monument to the U.S. colored troops to mark and explain the fact that so many of them are buried in the cemetery. And then, of course, I get a comment from a person who doesn't understand the history of the cemetery that, yeah, well, what about all the other people who are buried there, and all the people from the Chalmette, you know, from the Battle of New Orleans that are buried there? And that's when you know that you're just dealing with, you know, you're just dealing with an angry white person, because they don't quite understand the origins of Chalmette National Cemetery. And that origin basically is that it was constructed out of the back of the Chalmette battlefield area in 1864 as a burial for Union soldiers and rebels, but basically was a burial ground for men and women who died in the Southern Rebellion. And that's the key thing there. Of all of that space, that 17 acres or so, 17 and a half acres of space, there are only 4 graves of soldiers from the War of 1812. And of those 4, only one of them was present at the Battle of New Orleans. So that's the thing, is like, you know, when you get, you know, the angry people, oh, what about all the people from the Battle of, it's only one guy. You know, that's the whole point to this, is that Chalmette National Cemetery isn't a War of 1812. It isn't a Battle of New Orleans graveyard. It's a Southern Rebellion graveyard. And that's the key. That is the key thing that, and again, yeah, I get the idea that when you've grown up with the Lost Cause mythos as opposed to fact, it becomes a challenge sometimes with these folks. I don't really have a lot of time for it, you know, when I'm looking through my posts on Facebook or comments on the website and that kind of thing. But this one just kind of struck me, and so I felt like we should talk about it a little bit more. The other thing that's important to note about Chalmette National Cemetery is, yes, it was constructed by the Union Army. So it's essentially in the view of many over the last 150 years or so, or more, well, not, yeah, a little more than 150 years, 155 years specifically, the idea that the cemetery itself was kind of in your face to the people of New Orleans, and because there's just the Lost Cause mythos presents the Union Army as an occupying force. Now, you could, yeah, there, that's a legitimate concern and a legitimate argument. However, there's a lot of people in New Orleans that were glad the Union reopened the port. So, you know, it's even that piece of this becomes it becomes in dispute. So take the Lost Cause mythos, though, and follow that through. Yeah, you could see where, in particular, that the ladies' organization that reinterred the rebel burials, the rebel soldiers that were buried in Chalmette Cemetery, back to private burial in the front of Greenwood Cemetery, right there at City Park Avenue and at the end of Canal Street, you kind of get that, right? You know, that, okay, all right, that's what you guys want to do. That's fine. You know, you don't want to bury your people with the African Americans who fought your people. All right, we get that. Okay, that kind of thing. But the idea that, you know, it's like it's a distinguished place and a place of honorable burial. It continues to be a place of honorable burial going well past. There are Vietnam veterans who are interred in Chalmette National Cemetery. So you have everything from these numbered markers for the U.S. colored troops to Civil War, well, you know, the War of 1812 veterans, then the Southern Rebellion and the colored troops markers going into the Spanish-American War and every other conflict going all the way up through Vietnam. Now, Chalmette National Cemetery is closed to burials now. It's pretty much full up. And as a matter of fact, in some points, there are trees and nature that are kind of taking over some of the smaller markers. You know, we've posted photos of that before, where, you know, the trees, the roots of trees are swallowing some of those, in particular, some of those numbered markers. But the catch is that, you know, it's like it's an honorable national cemetery, and it deserves that level of respect. And the men who started that cemetery, in particular, the colored troops, deserve recognition for their contribution during the Southern Rebellion. Now, one of the other things, just as a side note, just to point this out, because you'll hear this from people who are taught the Lost Cause mythos as fact. One of the things that some older folks tend to do is they tend to conflate some of the what they perceive as the evils of Benjamin Butler and start throwing it all together. And it's like, well, yeah, he took away that, you know, that sacred ground at Chalmette and gave it to the Union. No. For openers, Butler was the first occupying commander took over in May 1st of 1862. Butler was gone by the end of 1862. So by 1864, it's not Butler. And that's the important thing. Yes, it's, you know, by 1864, the port's been reopened. It's the city of New Orleans is functioning again as part of the United States. And in particular, the Union Army and the Union Navy are using the port as a base, as, you know, the bottom base, the anchor of the movement to suppress the rebellion in the West. So, and it was, you know, it was a very important and significant thing. And of course, it's the big city, it's the big port. You have men that are being brought down that are in, that are wounded. They expire from their wounds or they're already dead. You've got to bury them someplace. It's perfectly logical to build out a cemetery there. It's a wonderful, sacred area. It's definitely worth your time. I wrote a scene in one of my novels that goes out to Chalmette Cemetery, because it is really a very peaceful place. There's just a lot of the vibe out there is incredible. So you definitely want to, you know, go take a look if you're visiting the city. If the last time you went to Chalmette Battlefield was back in the day when your eighth grade or seventh grade field trip went out there, you can still take the Creole Queen, goes out to Chalmette and docks there, so you can get off the riverboat there and go walk around in the battlefield and, of course, in the cemetery. just enjoy that peacefulness and the fact that that cemetery is there to honor men who fell in the service of the United States. So yeah, it's just get that straight though, that it's this cemetery is, I don't want to say it's exclusively an African-American cemetery, but there are so many of those men, of those USCT soldiers that are buried there, that it's an important part of Black history in the United States, particularly in New Orleans. And like I said, I'll show you the link. I'll show you the stuff on that monument up in Missouri, and you can kind of get the idea of, you know, where that is and why we should have one here. And that's our show. A little short form pod. We've got a couple other things cooking in terms of interviews and talks with other folks that we're setting up. So we'll do some more, and we'll do some more long form stuff as we go along, of course. So hope you guys have a good week, and we will catch you next week.